Welcome to Carry the Fire, a podcast where we explore the big questions of life through the lens of the good, the true, and the beautiful. I'm your host, Dustin Kensrue, and my hope is that through these conversations with people of diverse and divergent backgrounds and beliefs, we can glimpse the world anew through each other's unique perspectives.
Fiction is something to a degree that you hide behind in a way, and it allows you to expose yourself. I always saw the characters that I played as like some aspect of myself turned up to like 12, mm-hmm. You know. Overall, I considered Black Parade to be a death fantasy. Death and rock and roll were kind of like intertwined. Every time you get on stage, you have to be prepared to die.
Hey everybody, it is episode 5 of the Carry the Fire podcast. Today we're joined by Gerard Way, who's the singer of the band My Chemical Romance, as well as also having released some killer music on his own. He spent the last few years, though, spending most of his time writing comics, including the very popular Umbrella Academy comics, which have recently been adapted into a great show on Netflix. In our conversation, we talk about creating worlds and inhabiting characters, talk about the beauty and difficulty of creative collaboration, the complexity of trying to incorporate time travel into a story, and we also get into Gerard's spirituality a bit. And I want to give a brief heads up for some of you regarding that. Gerard's going to talk about magic and witchcraft. And while I'm no expert on either, I do know enough to know that these words in this context probably don't mean what most of you think they do. Some of you might not bat an eye hearing them, but a lot of you probably came up inside a worldview where someone who was interested in these things was considered very evil. Gerard is very far from that. If I can try to provide a new framework for you, it would be this. Generally, modern practices of magic and witchcraft, while being diverse in form, incorporate various insights and rituals from animistic pagan and folk religion, as well as incorporating some psychological intuitions from different fields and traditions. Practitioners generally tend to be very concerned with the earth and our connection with it. While this is not my spiritual tradition or practice, I recognize that we all have things to learn from each other. And I think especially the ideas in these traditions about finding our place within the natural world are a helpful corrective to a lot of the Western tradition's tendency to want to dominate over nature, rather than seeing ourselves as part of an interconnected web of being. I had no idea we'd be talking about any of this going into this conversation, but in the spirit of this podcast, I was so excited to hear from another unique perspective on the good, the true, and the beautiful, and I hope you will be too. Let's get into it. Thank you so much for doing this.
No problem.
It's super good to see you.
You too.
I'm trying to think of the last time we even saw each other, and it was probably on tour.
Was it on the arena tour?
That's what I'm thinking.
And it's been a long
playing
time.
Playing a bunch of World of Warcraft.
Yeah, that's my strongest memory. I have a lot of great memories of you guys, obviously, but the one that sticks out in my head the most is when we're all playing Warcraft in this big room, and you had to go on stage, and you literally had your rig hooked up. You had your in-ears. They weren't in yet, but you were wired up, and I believe you even had a guitar, and you were still playing, and you went you went literally from the keyboard, from the computer, right on stage.
Dude, I got way too addicted to that game. It's your guys' fault.
It was our fault, yeah.
No, dude, it was so fun. It was probably like, what, 8 or 9 of us playing in like a room.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a tour after that or two. And I had started just dreaming in Warcraft. And like I went on stage one day, and I was on stage, and I just had this moment. I was like, I'm done. I can't. Because I had tried to like wean a little bit, and it wasn't working. I was like, I got to go to cold turkey.
Yeah.
And I got off stage, and I like gave someone the Warcraft. See, don't give this back to me. I'm done. I deleted it. Yeah. Which is funny because I seriously haven't played video games since then until I just bought my kids a Switch.
Okay.
And they're playing Zelda.
Zelda,
and then
yeah.
I decided to treat myself. And
nice,
so I got,
nice.
I got a Switch for the road.
Yeah, I've been playing
Zelda's
that.
The best.
Yeah, I played Zelda with my daughter, and it's a lot of. It's so big, though. We're having a really hard time getting a handle on the game because it's so vast, you know?
Yeah, it is crazy.
I had to quit Warcraft, too. I had to go cold turkey because it was still in my life when I wanted to write the Umbrella Academy.
Oh.
And I actually had this, I was at the crossroads and I had this moment where I was like, I can either play Warcraft or I could write this comic.
I mean, it's a time sink.
It's totally.
That game especially, yeah. Like just the social aspect, the like, it just ends up being enormous.
Yeah, yeah. So that was it. I quit, never looked back.
So, I was going to ask you, prompted you earlier to think about it, what was something that gave you a feeling of wonder as a kid?
Okay, so I have a couple like really
multiple
obvious
things.
I have a couple of real obvious answers. I know this is such an obvious one, but Star Wars was really big.
Uh-huh.
You know, it just was, and I know it was for, you know, millions of people. Like, you know, once I saw that, it was like the first movie my parents ever took me to see, and I was really young. But the thing back then is they were running these in theaters for like 3 years, you know. Like,
oh, really? I don't think I realized that.
Yeah, like so Star Wars had come out, and then they just kept running it until The Empire came out. Like, so, you know, I was like, I must have been 2 or something, and they brought me to the theater.
Oh, wow. I think I remember, so I think my first memory of going to a movie was seeing, was Jedi 84?
83, yeah. 83. I think it was 83.
So I remember going to see that, like standing in line with my dad.
Me and too.
Like, yeah, it was the first, I don't know. There's just those moments where you're like, you have those, I remember like listening to certain records in my dad's car
or
something.
Yeah, yeah.
And like he'd turn it up loud.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of my favorite memories of my dad, is him picking me up from school early and then taking me to go see Jedi.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, we waited in big lines. They wrapped around.
Mm-hmm.
Even back then, there was a couple people ordering pizza. You know, that's, you know, one of my favorite times. One of my favorite memories of being with my dad. So
that's super cool. What about Star Wars specifically like created that wonder? Was it like the world? Was it
the world? It was the world. The scope. You know, just this world you wanted to live in, mm-hmm. and you wish existed, and. You know, there was only 3 movies back then, and so your brain would kind of fill in the gaps, like, oh, what is it like? What are their supermarkets like, or what are? And your brain would kind of, and later that would come into play when I would play RPGs, which is another thing I'll bring up in a minute. But there was a time where I was in college or right before college where we were playing a Star Wars RPG that I was running, and it's just such a rich world,
like a tabletop one.
Yeah, tabletop. Okay. Yeah, and. It was like a really great game, and it was super epic because, and the one thing about it is everybody already had a sense of that world in their head.
Yeah.
So
you don't
it
have
made
to
it,
build that already.
Yeah, you didn't have to build
it. You add
on to
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So they all knew the world. So when you would describe something, everybody had a vivid picture in their head. And then anything you hadn't seen before, you would just describe. And then, but people had a point of reference, so they would know.
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, Star Wars, that was like the first one, and I was just obsessed with that for my whole childhood, you know, playing with the action figures with Mikey, and we had our own Sarlacc pit, which is a dirt pit and stuff like that. And then the other thing that was really important to me were tabletop RPGs. So I was in the 3rd grade at a new school, but I still hung out with my best friend who was still at the old school anyway. Basically, he had an older brother. His friend had an older brother in college.
Okay.
And so he was way into D&D, and he would run D&D for us, and we're all 3rd graders. That was like a major moment
for
me.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was. And to have like a college, you know, aged dungeon master who had knew the game inside out was like a really amazing way to play.
That's very cool.
Yeah. And that really, that opened up a big world for me. Like, I never stopped playing since the 3rd grade, and then I took a try at being a dungeon master. And even just from playing and dungeon mastering, I learned how to tell stories.
Uh-huh.
And I was really into that. And it you know, you'd learn things even about leadership if you go to become the party leader, or if you're the DM, you learn how to keep people engaged, you know. You learn how to keep momentum, things moving. And things
yeah, that's
like that.
Interesting. I feel like that's something that, I don't know, maybe a lot of storytellers are not paying as much attention to as they used to. There's the book I brought you. It's called Invisible Ink.
Oh, cool.
This guy, Brian McDonald, who's kind of like story guru. He consults at Pixar all the time, teaches screenwriting and stuff. He's very, very cool. But he grew up like watching a bunch of like the classic movie directors coming through like the 60s, 70s, whatever. And they all had this vision of like what stories were and really paid attention to like how they thought about how the audience would react. Imagine them in the theater or whatever. And then something he was talking about, just he feels like it's just dropped off. Like that interplay of trying to like connect and let that influence how you're actually creating the story.
Yeah. No, I'm excited to read that. I'm a big fan of structure and I'm a big fan of outlines.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'll like this.
Yeah. Good. I'm a big fan of those things because the way I see it, if you know your whole story, and I always feel like you don't need to know all the details, you don't need to know all of it, but you should know kind of, you should have some kind of outline or a structure, and then you get to have fun because you do know the beats you need to hit, but all the spaces in between, you get to fill that in, you know, and you get,
I think it's rare that anyone doesn't do that and does it well. Like Stephen King's maybe the only one that I can think of that just doesn't write that way. And somehow he just has internalized it or something and it ends up working itself out. But
yeah.
That's cool, man. So would you say like those kinds of things, these imaginary worlds, these built worlds are like the things that still bring you like kind of the most wonder and joy in a sense?
Yes. And it's something that I wanted to do when I grew up. Like I wanted to, you know, build my own worlds that people could share and be a part of. And that was something I did all throughout the band, was just kind of, you know, and building all these different worlds and the people that inhabit those worlds and the details down to like the stickers on the Trans Am for Danger Days. Like those were all planned out. Like, so my favorite thing to do is kind of world building, you know? And I've done it for projects that haven't come to fruition as well. Like I was working on this sci-fi TV show for a while and I just went deep and I just came up with, you know, with my friend John Rivera, we came up with this whole world, you know? So world building is something I'm a big fan of, and it's something that I've noticed people talk about when they're talking about either my work with Umbrella Academy or My Chemical Romance is the world building aspect.
Yeah.
So, you know, world building as a job title isn't a job, but I think it's like that element is, I feel like, one of my strengths, you know?
Yeah. As far as that, like the world building, I feel like you've not only like built those worlds, but like with MCR, like you lead in inhabiting them in a way.
Yeah.
Like that's, it's fun to watch. It's scary for me, like a little bit, like watching, like, is it scary for you? Or is that like, is it safe for you? Like to like be in that character? And
That's a good question. I think there's a bit of safety that comes with being a character, you know, and obviously I was looking up to my heroes when I was constructing that. I was looking at like David Bowie, especially like around Black Parade. And that's when I was like, oh, I'm going to be a character, you know. Early Black Parade stuff was like, I had written this line out that basically said like, what if Death had a rock band? And it obviously changed from that, and we all became Death in a way, the whole band. But I there is a safety with inhabiting a character, and there was like the character I was during Black Parade was fun because I think in an entertaining way or a positive way, like there was this level of disdain that you would have for your audience as playing as the Black Parade, but it was to me like a healthy kind because you were just playing really.
Yeah.
I thought that was a fun aspect of that character. But then, you know, there's a lot of you in the character, and it's kind of, I always saw the characters that I played as like some aspect of myself turned up to like 12, you know? You know, it's interesting when I would meet people like afterwards and stuff, they would be like, oh, I didn't think you were going to be like so normal when I met you just because of the way I would act on stage. And I met a lot of kids are like, oh, I thought you were going to be such a jerk.
Oh, that's funny.
Because I would play one,
you
know, and it was just part of the drama for me.
Yeah, that's cool. Have you read any Ursula K. Le Guin?
I love her. Okay. I just reread Earthsea.
Okay, I haven't read it. I've heard that's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
I've just got into. I read The Left Hand of Darkness.
Oh, I've not finished that, but I've loved.
It is
what I've read.
A very slow book in a sense. Like it's not exciting in a sense, but it's got this patient movement, and by the end I was just floored by it. It's fantastic. Yeah.
I have to finish that one. You know, I love her, and her work, especially Left Hand of Darkness, it does have a patient movement. I think that's the best way to describe it. And I've also loved the way that she talks about storytelling and writing. And one thing I read from her recently that really stuck with me is this quote of hers, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't know if I'm getting it exact, but she basically said, like, not every story needs to have a message. Mm-hmm. You know, it could just be the act of telling a story. It doesn't, you don't have to like lecture your readership or your audience or hit them over the head with this like big message. It doesn't have to have one.
Which is interesting, you know? Because I feel like she is a very message oriented writer in a certain way, but maybe that's coming in a very natural sense. Lewis talked about that too, where he was like, the last thing you want to do is write this thing that's just didactic. It's just trying to tell something. He's like, whatever truth that you actually like believe deep down, like those things are coming out if you just write.
If you just write, I agree.
If you
with
write,
that.
If you, I mean, like Narnia apparently started from, he had a picture in his head of a fawn in a snowstorm holding a parcel with an umbrella. Like that's like the whole world like built out of that, and he loved that image.
And
his love for it like blossomed into something.
Yeah, you know? That's awesome. Yeah,
it's super cool. So the beginning of, in the intro of Left Hand of Darkness, Le Guin says, so I'm an artist and therefore a liar. Distrust everything I say. I'm telling the truth. The only truth I can understand or express is logically defined a lie, psychologically defined a symbol, aesthetically defined a metaphor. So even when you're making music, you're talking about, you're making these fictions, you're lying, as it were. I was watching something the other day. You said something like, sometimes fiction's closer to fact, or something in that range. Is that accurate of how you feel about creating, that like sometimes by, like you're getting at a deeper truth by telling a fiction?
Yeah, that can happen. And I think it's kind of magical when it does happen, you know? you know, Black Parade especially is filled with a lot of metaphors. And, you know, maybe the fiction is something to a degree that you hide behind in a way. And it allows you to expose yourself. Because exposing yourself is really hard. And one of the, you know, just allowing yourself to be vulnerable is really hard. And one of the things that Rob Cavallo said to me when he was producing Black Parade was like, you know, making a record, a great record, is like you're almost like pulling open your insides and you're like pulling all your guts out and things like that. And it's a brutal process because of that. But I think I did that on that record a lot. You know, there's a lot of like self-loathing, and there's, you know, the Catholic kind of guilt I grew up with, what appears in stuff like Mama and House of Wolves, and how you think you're destined for hell and things like that. But it's cool. Yeah, fiction gives you a way to like express these things and make yourself vulnerable and open yourself up. And that's the ways I like to use it. And then there's sometimes stuff that's just, you know, straight fiction or fantasy. Like overall, I considered Black Parade to be a death fantasy, like a rock and roll death fantasy, because I thought death and rock and roll were kind of like intertwined in a way, because, you know, I think Mick Jagger had said once that every time you get on stage, you have to be prepared to die. And like there's
that's
this
amazing.
Yeah. And there's like this. So it was like this rock and roll death fantasy, Black Parade.
That's cool. I have the worst memory. So I was preparing for this, and then somebody was like, I asked Gerard if he really wrote treatment for the Image of the Invisible video, and I was like, holy shit, I had totally
forgot
that you did that.
Oh my god, that was so fun too. I totally forgot. I gotta rewatch that.
But what was funny too is I was watching your videos, and I was like, this is so cool, these characters, whatever. I was like, I've never really done that. I was like, I guess Image of the Invisible is kind of like that, but didn't even make the connection. But it's totally that way because you were building that world.
That was so much fun. I got to
live in it. And
that's
cool.
Yeah, I was really honored that you asked me to conceptualize a video for you guys.
That was fun. That was like, I don't think we've ever had another one. It was like this. Definitely not such a developed story.
It's right. Great. Didn't we do something too where we had lights on their helmets?
Yeah.
That was like, their eyes were supposed to be lights.
Yeah, there was like a, maybe it was like a single eye. It was like a red.
Right.
Kind of like lasery light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'm going to rewatch that when we're done.
So you grew up with the Catholic guilt, you said. Mm-hmm. Like, did you ever feel like you inhabited that world, or was it something being kind of like thrust on you that you didn't? I mean, it's hard as a kid, you don't even know. Like, but mm-hmm. curious about like that, and then where you'd feel like your kind of big frame worldview is now, and like, what are we all doing on this rock?
Right,
and,
right. My family and my parents, they weren't super religious. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from this like Italian Catholic background though, so it was the kind of thing my grandmother would go to church sometimes, but never like would push us to really go. But like for Christmas or something, my mom would go with her. Mm-hmm. But I think my parents thought, you know, this is the right thing to do. Yeah. We should raise our child with believing in God and raise them Catholic because we're good, you know, even though we're not always there, we're good Catholics. So they kind of put me on that path. And, you know, I think the first thing I learned from being Catholic or just religion in general, maybe it's at times specific to Catholicism, is this fear, mm-hmm. you know, and this fear of hell. Yeah. That's what they really instilled in us. I think I was in like the first grade too or something, really young.
Yeah.
And there was this thing that would happen where they would talk about death and hell and all that stuff. And I would like, there was this period because of these classes, these after school classes, I would have these bouts of like just crying, you know. I guess I was coming to terms with the fact that my parents wouldn't be there forever, or I would lose them, mm-hmm. or they would die. Mm-hmm. But then the additional fear, like, well, if they've behaved bad, they'll go to hell, and I'll go to hell too. And so there was this period where it was like really upsetting for me, and I channeled that. I tapped into that stuff on a couple records and on Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge. I borrowed a lot of Catholic imagery, mm-hmm. and like that second video for Helena being in the church and things like that. So I kind of started in some of our merch designs too. I remember we had one with a cathedral and a rosary and all this stuff. And then that would come to a head in the song Mama on Black Parade. But yeah, like my journey in terms of spirituality and where I came with that. So obviously at some point I was confirmed in the fifth grade. So I did that. But then after that, my parents didn't have any more requirements out of me.
Yeah.
Because I think it was all about baptism, communion, and confirmation.
Yeah.
And if you did those three things, you're good. Then you could go as you wanted, mm-hmm. you know. So they never pushed me to go. And then, you know, over the years, I mean, obviously I got into punk rock and I didn't believe in God for the longest time. And then I just started to really need spirituality in my life, mm-hmm. as I got older. And I'm more of the sense where I believe in there being some, I don't know if it's a God, but I do believe there's something.
Something, yeah.
Yeah. There's something out there. There's some kind of reason. And I also believe we come from, you know, we come from star stuff. Like we come from the universe. We're birthed from the universe. I'm a believer in the fact that the universe is chaos and born out of chaos, and it's uncontrollable. And, you know, there's kind of no rhyme or reason to anything, and tragedies and accidents and bad things happen and good things happen. And it's really just chaos being like this constant true thing in the universe. And I came to those kind of discoveries through my study of magic, occultism, and things like that, which, you know, I was inspired to do by my friend Grant Morrison, who he's kind of like a big brother to me, mentor. Mm-hmm. Like, he's really supportive, and he's very into magic, and so I became interested in. He's given me some lessons, and you know, I actually wanted to do a podcast one day with him where I literally just sit down with him and have him talk about magic, because mm-hmm. the way he describes it is like, You would almost need it to be recorded,
yeah,
to fully explore all the theories and things like mm-hmm. that. So, you know, I studied magic, like high magic, chaos magic, and eventually witchcraft. And, you know, witchcraft is something I felt more comfortable with, because I always felt like when I was reading about chaos magic, it felt like it was about making the universe bend to your will, mm-hmm. whereas I was looking for something more that you were in service to the universe.
Interesting.
You know, I think I got this from reading Crowley's book on magic, but basically, I don't know exactly what he said, but basically, reality is your perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, and that was kind of one of the key points of magic. Like, your brain builds your reality.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really great takeaway from all that. You know, so. I've been really interested in spirituality and things like that, and studying shamanism and and all that stuff. And we, you know, with our daughter, like, we didn't raise her with religion, but we, Lindsay, my wife, is really spiritual too. And not like a practicing witch or anything, but she's just naturally adept at those kind of things. She's really in tune with nature. She knows a ton about herbology. A lot of the founding cornerstones of witchcraft is just kind of part of her life. And so we do raise Bandit with, you know, like Lindsay teaches her all about herbs and plants. And mm-hmm. we have a witch's garden and communicating with nature and trees and animals and things like that. So we're teaching our daughter like that. There is a kind of magic to life, and magic does exist. It's not like Harry Potter magic, but, you know.
So a lot of that seems like it's about an embodiedness, a connectedness, mm-hmm. right, to everything, to other people, mm-hmm. to...
Yeah, connectedness, for sure, yeah. Yeah, and just teaching her that she's connected to the universe. And if she grows up and wants a different kind of religion, you know, that's great, too. And I know I explored those... I was looking for a religion in art school. Because I had a class where we had to study all the religions, mm-hmm. you know, or most of them. And I kept, like, going from each one, and I was like, well, I like bits of this one, but I don't like that. And I couldn't find one that I landed on, mm-hmm. you know, until I got later in life into more spiritual things like magic and witchcraft. And things.
Cool. So with something like witchcraft, which for a lot of people are going to hear and have, like, not at all the idea that you're talking about, I think. So something like the idea of like goodness in that, like where is it derived from? Is it coming out of the interconnectedness? Like it seems like there's a moral view to it rather than it being like morality being a decree, maybe. It's mm-hmm. something that arises out of those connections.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I think the positivity in it to me, like, and here's the thing, I don't consider myself a practicing witch or anything. Like I just read a ton of this stuff. And that's one of the things they kind of warn you about with magic and everything. Like you could read all the books you want, and some people spend their whole life reading books and never practice, but the thing they tell you to do is practice, you know. And I think the goodness comes from being in service to the earth, mm-hmm. you know, and being connected to that. And also what I've learned about witchcraft, or at least the kind of witchcraft that I like, is it's very gray. You know, you're not it's not black magic, it's not totally white magic. It's just understanding that the universe and all things in it are very gray. There's no black and white to mm-hmm. everything. And I really like that the most, you know, because as I get older, like when I was younger, I was very black and white about a lot of things, yeah. you know, especially in the earlier days of My Chemical Romance, everything was really military and rigid and black and white, and this is right and this is wrong. And then you kind of get older and you start to realize, oh, no, things aren't that simple. Not everybody's all good or all bad.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a grayness there. And
yeah, which I think, yeah. I have a song on the latest Thrice Striker called The Gray, and it's dealing with that idea of deconstructing the black and the white. And I think the biggest danger there is the idea that, like, even if there was like straight black, straight white, like you are betting a lot on your ability to discern it,
right,
at any given moment.
You are.
And then if you are actually holding to it, like that, and you're basically betting on your ability to discern this thing, and now it's of the most ultimate consequence, and you filter out everything that doesn't fit into that,
right.
Which is basically a bunch of yourself and a bunch of everyone around you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hey, everyone. I hope you're enjoying this episode with Gerard Way. If you are, I wanted to let you know that you can become an active participant in the crafting of the content of the show by supporting us on Patreon. Becoming a patron will give you access at different tiers to a variety of rewards, including additional patron-only episodes, the ability to submit questions for our guests, and to interact online with me and other patrons, and could even mean an appearance on an episode to ask me your own questions. And by joining by the end of the year, you'll automatically become a member of the Flint and Steel Founders Club, and will receive an exclusive enamel pin, as well as more rewards in the future. If you're digging this podcast and want to join me and others like you in our pursuit of the good, the true, and the beautiful, then joining us on Patreon is the best way to do it. Sign up today at patreon.com/carrythefirepod. All right, let's get back to the show. So I have a couple questions I'll pepper in here from some of the patrons. James Corbett said, what is the purest form of goodness you've experienced as a human being, and how do you explain it?
Purest form of goodness.
It's deep.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's from someone or just internally.
The purest form of goodness. It's a tough question, but it's a great question. I think the purest form of goodness is forgiveness. Mm. Or that would be something that I'd say is a very strong form of goodness. Like, even when you see people that, you know, the most terrible things happen to them, like a serial killer murders their loved one, and then some of these people, not all of them, and I don't blame the ones that don't find forgiveness, but some of them find forgiveness and able to forgive people for the most atrocious things, you know? Yeah. And so that feels like a really powerful form of goodness.
Yeah. I feel like in the middle of me deconstructing a lot of stuff, like something I was like, the idea of grace and forgiveness, like something goes deep there, and I'm not willing to like let go of that.
Mm-hmm.
Over the centuries, there's been countless efforts to define beauty. Aristotle defines beauty as having order, symmetry, and definiteness, but it's always struck me as a fairly anemic version of beauty. And then I saw on the cover of the My Chem single, Sing, there's a question on there that says, would you destroy something perfect in order to make it beautiful?
Right.
This makes me think that you probably also take issue with that definition a bit. I wanted to ask, is there something about brokenness that's near the heart of beauty for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that I was trying to remember that phrase a couple months ago too, that was on the cover to Sing. Yeah. Would you destroy something perfect to make it beautiful? And yeah, I think beauty is way more complex than symmetry. You know, I think there is a brokenness to beauty. I think, you look at like a lot of musicians, you could arguably say some, like from a certain perspective, if you subscribe to symmetry and things like that, a lot of musicians or front people, men and women in bands, like some of them, you could say like, well, they're not like traditionally beautiful, or mm-hmm. not what you would think of as beautiful, but something about their vulnerability or their confidence and things like that make them beautiful, mm-hmm. you know? And that's in any case, and you know, even non-musicians, like people that just go to work in the world, have normal jobs, like, There is something about beauty that is much deeper than just like what you see visually, you know?
One of the patrons was saying that Mike Hem's music said it reinforced to me and my friends that being an outcast was okay. Was that something that you wanted people to feel? What were things growing up that made you feel like it was okay to be an outcast or a misfit?
Yeah, I think by the time I was definitely not in elementary school, I didn't have to struggle with being an outcast in elementary school. I actually went to it was a cool school. It was just a normal public school. Mm-hmm. But like the one thing I thought looking back was very interesting about those years is we all got along. We were all friends, mm-hmm. Even the weirdest kids. And we all, like a lot of the kids would just have these parties back then and then everybody was invited. Mm-hmm. And then my first real experience with being an outsider was going to middle school. And then so you aren't all friends anymore. Yeah. And there's all divisions and cliques and things like that. And then I found myself to be one of these outcasts, one of these weird kids that listened to heavy metal and wore flannels, mm-hmm. you know? And there was like only a handful of us in the school that were like that. But it wasn't until high school where I fully embraced kind of being an outcast. The first year, freshman year, was really hard because I was really an outcast and I didn't even know where to sit at the lunch tables because I didn't fit in with any of these groups, you know? And it turns out I ended up sitting with a table of metalheads and because they saw me sitting by myself. And they're like, why don't you sit with us? And that's where I would learn about certain bands that they were into, like Murphy's Law and just the kind of thing they were listening to back then. But it was important for me to have something that spoke to outsiders with My Chemical Romance because when I was that age, there wasn't anything that really spoke to me like that. Or there wasn't like something so specific to being an outcast. There was lots of stuff that if you were an outcast, you listened to, like The Cure or The Smiths. And so, of course, I found all those bands, you know. But there was nothing like specifically geared to like somebody that feels invisible or as an outcast or rejected and things like that. So when we started My Chem, it felt very much like we were channeling the energy of being an outcast onto whoever listened to us. And in the early days, it wasn't a lot of kids. I mean, there wasn't kids that really listened to us. It was like kind of older punk rockers. It was mm-hmm. very interesting in the beginning. And of those older punk rockers, a lot of them were actually outcasts as well.
Yeah.
You know, within a scene. So And maybe they weren't even full-on punk rockers. They were just like a guy with a leather jacket at a bar who just saw something in us, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. The patron Jonathan Clark is asking, do you have any rituals or practices that you do to find your center, wait for a yes, get connected, see the good, the true, the beautiful in others, or let go a bit? Basically, he's kind of asking, you have any like meditative mindfulness, some kind of practice?
Right. I really enjoy TM, Transcendental Meditation. Mm-hmm. I actually am in an interesting spot with it, though. Like,
and that's where you're chanting like one...
A mantra, yeah. Have a mantra and you kind of like, you just repeat it in your head. You know, it helps you. Basically, when you're doing it, it releases negative energy and tension and things like that. And it's very good. But sometimes, at least in my experience, and this is why I've kind of paused my practice at the moment, and like sometimes it could release trauma and things like that. And sometimes you end up reliving that, and it makes it... And granted, your body is letting go of it, but sometimes it's hard. And I found when it would get its most intense, I would catastrophize things, you know, in my head. And be so I would be focusing on the mantra, but then things would happen like... like I would be thinking about like the worst things that could happen to my family or my loved ones or something bad happening to them or getting
Is that
hurt.
Something that you happens to you, like do tend to catastrophize in general?
I do tend to catastrophize sometimes, and it's something I work on in therapy. Like I'm a big believer in talk therapy, and I don't try to push medication on anybody, but I always just share my experience and that it's helped me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was somebody who was extremely imbalanced all through the years of My Chemical Romance and go through these like extreme highs and crushing lows where I wouldn't get out of bed for like 3 months. But then I would be in a manic phase and I would be up till 4 a.m. working on zines all of a sudden. And I would say to Lindsay, I would say, I don't need to sleep. Like, why do people sleep? I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a lot of that. And then Lindsay found me a therapist and we did a lot of really hard work and I faced myself a lot. I looked inward. And at the same time, before we explored and did the work, we stabilized my brain chemistry. That was the key. Once we were able to stabilize my brain chemistry.
You're able to actually
do the work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am a big believer in TM. It's just that sometimes I struggle with it, but I know all I have to do is check in with a TM center and go through explain what I'm going through. And actually my therapist had found me this woman who's one of the heads of, I'm not sure if it's the David Lynch Foundation or something else. And she actually said, oh, you should come in. I'll talk to you. I'll walk you through the trauma stuff and all the hard stuff. But I am a big believer in it because when it was cooking, and there was 2 months this year where it was totally changing my life until like some of the negative stuff came out, you know. It was like more productive, more focused, calmer, more engaged, more present. Like, so I'm a believer in it and a big believer in therapy and just having somebody to talk to.
Yeah, that's awesome. On the drive up, I was thinking about Umbrella Academy and... I love it in general. I remember getting the comic when it came out. The show turned out so great. Are you really happy with it?
Yeah, I'm totally happy. Like, you know, at the end of the day, like, it was somebody else's vision, and I was able to, like, let go of that. I think I needed to. When the process first started in making it a TV show,
It's gotta be hard. Like,
it's hard.
It's your baby.
Yeah. But I was really upfront when I was talking. I went in to meet with UCP and Dawn and... the people there, and I was with Dark Horse, and they said, what is your goal? And I said, my goal is to make great comics because I already went through a whole big thing with Universal trying to make this as a movie, and it just drained me. And it was full of, like, really difficult things that took up a lot of my time and disappointments, and I really turned my focus back to comics, you know, because I was like, that's where you're in charge. Like, nobody... You have an editor, obviously, if you have a great editor, you're doing great work together and you're making changes, but it doesn't feel like something creative is being ruled by committee, you know? And that's what it feels like in Hollywood. I was really upfront with Dawn, and I said, I want to make great comics so you guys have good material and make a good show. You know, I ended up being more involved in that. The extent of my involvement is like giving notes, especially about things like wardrobe, costumes, the look, feel of the world, the fact that it's kind of an alternate reality, and I give notes on scripts and I give notes on edits and things like that. So I am involved for sure. But I was able to realize this is somebody else's baby, you know, and I'm happy with the results for sure. And my whole thing is like the proof is in the fact that like everybody loves it.
I like Klaus a lot, and I can't remember because I read the comics a long ago how true to the book that character is.
Right.
Do you feel like it's capturing what you were trying to get at with it, or
it's capturing to me what Robert, who plays Klaus, is he's capturing this kind of sadness and tragedy to mm-hmm. the character, you know. Also, obviously, the humor. In the comic, Klaus is a little bit more of a what I call a dry goth. You know, he's very nihilistic in some ways.
And not quite as whimsical, maybe.
Yeah, not quite as whimsical as what Robert ended up doing. But the way Robert approached the character really ended up working. And he adds a lot of humanity to the character that maybe there's not so much of it. Or you don't see it very often in the comic with Klaus. Mm-hmm. You know, Klaus just does bad things and makes bad decisions and... Obviously, a lot of that is coming from a place of trauma that he experienced as a child. And in the show, it's cool because the drug use is there to help him quiet the voices in his head.
Yeah.
And they explored that a lot deeper, and I thought that that was really cool. You know,
is that less a focus in the comic?
A little bit. I just never really explored the fact that he's constantly seeing and hearing and talking to ghosts. And so these drugs kind of quiet his mind, you know. I never explored that really deeply.
Which is cool, though, because it's another evidence of you, you know, you were building a world and someone else was living in it. And then they were like, well,
of
course. He's like, oh, dang, that's.
Yeah, that's the cool thing. They're able to point at things you weren't seeing because, you know, sometimes when I'm doing stuff like creating a world like Umbrella Academy, like a lot of it is running off the subconscious.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is some things you don't realize you're putting in there, you know? And then when they look at making a TV show or a movie, they really kind of deconstruct it and look at it and say like, well, this makes sense because of this. And
Some of the beauty with a comic, I think, is that the concise kind of form makes it to where you don't always have to trace down all these rabbit trails, but when you're trying to blow it up into something else, you've got to like figure out how to make sense of it all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to bring it back to the question of a sense of wonder, that was the other thing I thought about this morning when you asked me the question was, what do I get a sense of wonder from? And comics were a big one, you know? Because to me, and then I would later, I would reinforce these feelings when I started making them and writing them. You can do anything in them. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's beautiful about them. And I also love the mechanics of them because there's definitely things you can do in comics you can't do in film and TV. And I love that. So I've really learned to embrace the medium when I'm writing them. I think I'm writing comics that are definitely comics and they're not just a TV show. You know, playing out in a comic. You know?
Yeah. How much do you like draw your own stuff just to get kind of your ideas going? Or is it more conceptual?
Quite a bit. No, yeah. Especially for something like less so on Doom Patrol, but Umbrella Academy, Gabrielle Ba, the artist, and I have this really cool relationship. And I think the ideas kind of need to start with me. And I'll do a sketch, and then Gabrielle will completely reinterpret that and kind of make it much cooler and much better. And
that's because that's your, like, complete world from scratch, whereas Doom Patrol, you're kind of reinventing.
In the beginning, Umbrella was definitely my complete world from scratch, and I had this idea. But Gabrielle, especially in the early days, he helped build that world. Mm-hmm. Like, I was able to give him a couple references, and I'm like, I don't know if maybe it's the 60s, maybe it's the 70s, or... people were dressed like the 60s and cars look like it from the 60s, but there's modern things too. And he loves drawing architecture, which you don't find a lot of in comics. A lot of people try to stay away from the buildings in the background and the architecture, but he embraces the architecture.
That's
so
cool.
He really built that world with me, you know, in the beginning. But we still have our process, and the process usually, not always, but usually is like, especially if it's like a villain or something like that, I'll do some kind of sketch, even if it's bad, and then Gabrielle will take that and make it something.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Collaboration is terrifying and super fun when it's working.
Yeah. when it's working, it's amazing. Yeah, I love collaborating, and I've learned to really embrace it over the years. Delegating and collaborating were two skills I really needed to get really good at, and I think I got better at collaborating after the band. Although we were pretty good about collaborating in the band, you know, I just got better at it though.
Yeah, it's definitely like for Thrice, it's like the most fun, but also the hardest thing for sure, and causes the most tension.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
It's just because you care, you know.
Because you care, yeah, you care, and sometimes, you know, sometimes you do see or hear a complete vision. You know, and so you want that realized.
I think that's the hardest part is you're like, I see all this and you're like, okay, but there's three other people. And
yeah,
every single time that I'm like set on something and then everyone else is like, dude, no, like every time by the end, like, I'm like, wait, what was I stuck on?
Yeah.
It didn't matter anymore. It was it's totally a psychological issue at that point.
It is.
Like, it has to be this way. Like, no, it could be a million ways. I mean, they're all different and cool.
Yeah, and that's what I learned too when collaborating on music is exactly what you just said. Like, yeah, like you don't even remember what you were hung up on
because
it's just much better after everybody's worked on it. You know?
I mean, it's very similar to being like super upset about something in the moment and you're just not thinking clear and you sleep and you wake up and you're like, what? I was real upset about that.
It
doesn't seem like a big deal anymore.
Yeah.
Time travel is a big thing in Umbrella Academy, which is notoriously troublesome, I think, to write stories with time travel and not have it just fall apart. If you're trying to get a specific future, you have to have a bunch of people constantly fixing these things.
Right.
I like that way of interpreting, because usually it's, oh, we fix this one thing, and it's like, and you expect it just to keep going straight. And
right.
No way.
Right. I really like that the show took that from the comic and really explored it. Mm-hmm. All these people making these little corrections. Sometimes they're violent corrections, but sometimes they're very simple, you know? But time travel is such a pain in the ass. Like, I did not envy them when they were starting to do the writer's room for Umbrella Academy.
To try to make it all work.
You know, they'd have to put up like these big timeline boards and be like, all right, this happens this year, this is, you know. And that's what I was doing when I was writing the second volume, Dallas, because there's not much. I don't think there's any real time travel besides number 5 coming back. There's no real time travel in volume 1, Apocalypse Suite. But Dallas is all about it. Mm-hmm. So that was the hardest volume I've ever had to write, because time travel is just, it's so hard.
Is there any stories that you like that you feel like do it really well?
I don't know if I've read enough time travel stories. I mean, I thought Back to the Future did it really well.
But then I always go like, I always get stuck on the idea that you have to, there's an endless cycle of Martys that have to go back.
And keep,
you know, like, and I... My brain breaks when I try to be like, but what if he doesn't? Then none of it works anymore. You know, like it all breaks.
Yeah, when it can break very easily. And I think almost every time travel story has the possibility of completely breaking. Or at least in some person's mind out there, it is broken, you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to take time travel stories almost at face value and be like, all right, this works.
You know? you can't. Well, I think part of that's on the writer or whoever's making it to address and deflect that Brian McDonald guy I was talking about, he talks about that somewhere where he's like, you've got to spot the problem and then you just need to like have some character address it and then like sweep it away. Like just so that it helps the whoever's watching or whatever, like it helps them be like, oh yeah, what about this? And oh, they thought about it.
Yep.
And they're dismissing it. And it's not like it's like making it perfect, right? It's
right.
But you're like, it gives you permission to let it go, I think.
Yeah. And you do have to address those concerns, you know. I realize my answer might have been possibly a little lazy about taking things at face value, but one of the things I had to do in Dallas was address every concern that I thought the reader would have.
Yeah, which is great. And when you do the addressing, it lets the reader or the watcher or whatever, like, it lets them let it go and enjoy the story.
Yeah, exactly. I'm about to start volume 4 of Umbrella Academy, and I'm really happy because I don't think it's going to have any time travel in it. So I think we're a little bit away from more time travel in Umbrella Academy.
All right, this is a question from Mike Morrell. He says, in his recent arc, Cliff Steele, a.k.a. Robot Man, regains his humanity, at least in outward form. But on Gerard's latest cliffhanger. Steel burns it all up after facing the painful inhumanity of someone with power to hurt him. And he says, I suppose my question is, how do we protect the precious beauty of our humanity while remaining vulnerable to those who had meaning in our lives?
Oh, wow. How do we protect that humanity? Well, that's like a big question, because especially with given how the world is now and the toxicity out there online and things like that, how do you protect your humanity? Because, you know, toxicity, like the kind that Cliff experiences when he goes to visit his mother in the nursing home, it's a very real thing, and it's something you have to deal with. And I don't know how you hold on to your humanity. It's hard sometimes, you know.
Well, while being vulnerable too.
While being vulnerable, yeah, exactly.
Which I guess is almost synonymous with holding on to your humanity. Yeah. Like, because you can close off, but that's not good.
I know this is, yeah, exactly. I know this isn't the healthy or great answer, but I think one of the things I kind of did was to kind of remove myself from certain social medias. But it wasn't unhealthy, because what I did was I decided to look inward at that point, you know. I could tell you, like, as many harsh people are on the internet, like, I was much harsher on myself, you know. And I looked in, I asked myself tough questions. I really asked myself what's right and wrong. I think about these things deeply when I'm writing. But holding on to humanity is very hard, you know. And Cliff, obviously, he doesn't hold on to that humanity. And he goes kind of back into his cage, you know, because that makes sense to Cliff.
His follow-up question was, and does skin make the man, or can metal reflect who we really are just as well?
I believe metal can reflect who we are just as well. I think Cliff Steele is very much Cliff, whether he's a human or a robot. Okay. You know, he's still Cliff. And I think that's one of the things that's great about the character and why he's so fun to write, because no matter what, he's still Cliff.
I wanted to just see if there's anything you've been listening to, watching, reading that you think people should check out.
Let's see. What have I been reading recently? Well, this is old, but I just decided to reread Lord of the Rings from start to finish. And I made it through the books rather quickly, and they're just such a joy to read. They're so relaxing. But there is a real buildup to Lord of the Rings. It gets so dark at one point. It's horrific. But there's like a calm and a peace to reading it, and the way Tolkien writes, you're just thinking about the greenery and the trees and then the rivers and all those things. And so it's a real relaxing read, for as much as it ramps up. But I have a hard time watching TV. I feel like really trapped when I'm watching it. So I tend not to watch it at all, which is interesting about having a TV show.
Yeah.
I bring a different perspective when I'm giving notes, because I don't watch a lot of TV, you know, and more or less the only TV I watch is edits of Umbrella Academy, you know.
Oh, wow.
But every once in a while, Lindsay will rope me into a show that she feels like I absolutely have to watch. And she did that with Breaking Bad, and I'm really grateful she did. You know, she literally rewatched the whole thing with me, made me watch it, and, you know, it's still one of the best I've ever seen. And then she got me into Cobra Kai. Have you seen that?
No, is it good?
I think it's really good. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Especially like the first season is like really, okay. Really amazing.
I had huge doubts about if that would be good at all.
You watch the first season, and one of the things that actually helped hook me into the show is the episodes are half hour. So it was really cool. So I didn't feel as much of a prisoner of the television when I was watching them, because we could just watch a half hour and be done. But
books don't make you feel that way. They expand.
Books are my favorite thing. Yeah. Books, that's, you know, how a lot of people will use a television to kind of tune out and shut off and relax. Like, I use books to do that, you know? So, like, there's piles of books next to my bed.
Thanks so much for sitting down, man. It was super good to talk to you.
You too. It's been a long time. I miss you.
Yeah.
If you have a moment today, it would help a ton if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with a friend. Be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at CarryTheFirePod. If you want to get more involved with the podcast, I invite you to check out our Patreon account at patreon.com/CarryTheFirePod, where you can sign up for as little as $10 a month. As a patron, you can weigh in on upcoming episodes, interact with me and other patrons, and also receive perks and special access to additional podcast episodes and content. And If you become a patron before the end of the year, you will be added to the Flint and Steel Founders Club as a special thank you for supporting the show early on. You'll receive additional perks beyond the regular tiers, including a limited Flint and Steel Founders Club enamel pin that we'll be sending out when the registration stops at the end of the year.
I want to thank my producer, Andy Lara, and all of our executive producers, Jonathan Clark, TJ Dween, Mark Francis, Dan Thompson, Mark Redfield, Drew Pera, Colin Hawthorne, Nathaniel Bailey, Stephen Saucier, John Buchan, Denise Sagita, Paul Pratt, Mark Weiss, Brianna Webb, John Engel, Tiffany Payne, Samantha Simmons, Jordan Goodman, Luz Enriquez, Brian Weisbecker, Matt Fuchs, Jess Card, Jeremy Robinson, William Galdamez, Eric Gonzalez, Sean Weidmeyer, John Paul Diego, David Cobb, Jordan Everly, Matthew Alcon, Joshua Malera, Max Glaser, and Ron Alberca.
And last but not least, sign up for email updates about upcoming guests and special show information at www.carrythefirepod.com. Thank you all so much for carrying the fire with me, and I'll see you next time.